Fed Moncasad had grown up in a culture of poverty and sudden death. As a member of the minority who still called themselves Palestinians, he and his family had lived in the slums of Tharsis, human testimony to the bitter legacy of the terminally dispossessed. Every Palestinian in the world web and beyond carried the cultural memory of a century of struggle capped by a month of nationalist triumph before the nuclear jihad of 2038 wiped it all away. Then came their second diaspora, this one lasting 5 centuries and leading to dead-end desert worlds like Mars, their dream buried with the death of old Earth. Kassad, like the other boys of the South Tharsis relocation camps, either ran with gangs or faced the option of being prey to every self-proclaimed predator in the camps. He chose to run with the gangs. Kassad had killed another youth by the time he was 16 standard years old. If Mars was known for anything in the world web, it was for hunting in the Mariner Valley, Schrouder's Zen Massif in Hellas Basin, and the Olympus Command School. Kassad did not have to travel to Mariner Valley to learn about hunting and being hunted. He had no interest in Zen Gnosticism. And as a teenager, he felt nothing but contempt for the uniformed cadets who came from every part of the web to train for force. He joined with his peers in sneering at the new Bushido as a code for faggots, but an ancient vein of honor in the young Kassad's soul secretly resonated to the thought of a samurai class whose life and work revolved around duty, self-respect, and the ultimate value of one's word. When Kassad was 18, a Tharsis province higher circuit judge offered him the choice of a Martian year at polar work camp or volunteering for the John Carter Brigade, then forming to help force put down the resurgent Glennon Height Rebellion in the Class 3 colonies. Kassad volunteered and discovered that he enjoyed the discipline and cleanliness of military life, even though the John Carter Brigade saw only garrison duty within the web and was dissolved shortly after Glennon Height's cloned grandson died on Renaissance. 2 days after his 19th birthday, Kassad applied to force ground and was turned down. He went on a 9-day drunk, awoke in one of the deeper hive tunnels of Lussis with his military comlog implant stolen by someone who apparently had taken a correspondence course in surgery, his universal card and Farcaster access revoked, and his head exploring new frontiers of pain. Kassad worked on Lussis for a standard year, saving over 6,000 marks and allowing physical labor in the 1.3 ES gravity to put an end to his Martian frailness. By the time he used his savings to ship out to Maui Covenant on an ancient solar sail freighter with jury-rigged Hawking drives, Kassad was still lean and tall by web standards, but what muscles there were worked wonderfully well by anyone's standards. He arrived on Maui Covenant 3 days before the vicious and unpopular island war began there, and eventually the force combined commander at first sight got so tired of seeing the young Kassad waiting in his outer office that he allowed the boy to enlist in the 23rd Supply Regiment as an assistant hydrofoil driver. 11 standard months later, Corporal Fedmon Kassad of the 12th Mobile Infantry Battalion had received 2 Distinguished Service Clusters, a Senate commendation for valor in the Equatorial Archipelago campaign, and 2 Purple Hearts. He was also tapped for Force Command School and shipped webward on the next convoy. Kassad dreamed of her often. He had never learned her name. She had never spoken. But he could have recognized her touch and scent in total darkness among 1,000 others. He thought of her as mystery. When other young officers went whoring or seeking girlfriends in the indigenous populations, Kassad would remain on base or take long walks through strange cities. He kept his obsession with mystery secret, knowing full well how it would read on a psych report. Sometimes, on bivouac under multiple moons, or in the womb-like zero-G of a troop transport hold, Kassad would realize how insane his love affair with a phantom truly was. But then, he would recall the small mole under her left breast, which he had kissed one night, feeling her heartbeat under his lips, as the ground itself shook from the firing of the big guns near Verdun. He would remember the impatient gesture with which she brushed back her hair as her cheek rested on his thigh. And the young officers would go to town or to the huts near the base, and Fedmon Kassad would read another history book or jog along the perimeter, or run tactical strategies on his comlog. It was not long before Kassad came to the attention of his superiors. During the undeclared war with the free miners in the Lambert Ring territories, it was Lieutenant Kassad who led the surviving infantry troops and marine guards in cutting through the bottom of the old asteroid bore shaft on Peregrine to evacuate the hegemony consulate staff and citizens. But it was during the short reign of the new prophet on Qum Riyad that Captain Fedmon Kassad came to the attention of the entire web. The force space captain of the only hegemony ship within 2 leap years of the colony world had been paying a courtesy call when the new prophet chose to lead 30 million New Order Shiites against 2 continents of Sunni shopkeepers and 90,000 resident hegemony infidels. The ship's captain and 5 of his executive officers were taken prisoner. Urgent fatline messages from Tau Ceti Center demanded that the ranking officer aboard the orbiting HS Deniev settle the situation on Qum Riyad, free all of the hostages, and dispose the new prophet, without resorting to the use of nuclear weapons within the planet's atmosphere. The Deniev was an aging orbital defense picket. It carried no nuclear weapons that could be used within an atmosphere. The ranking officer on board was Force Combined Captain Fedmon Kassad. On the 3rd day of the revolution, Kassad landed the Deniev's single assault boat in the main courtyard of the Grand Mosque at Mashhad. He and the other 34 force troopers watched as the mob grew to 300,000 militants kept at bay only by the boat's containment field and the lack of an order to attack by the new prophet. The new prophet himself was no longer in the Grand Mosque. He had flown to the northern hemisphere of Riyadh to join in the victory celebrations there. 2 hours after he landed, Captain Kassad stepped out of his ship and broadcast a short announcement. He said that he had been raised as a Muslim. He also announced that the interpretation of the Quran since the Shiites' seedship days had definitely shown that the God of Islam would neither condone nor allow the slaughter of the innocent, no matter how many jihads were proclaimed by tin-horned heretics like the new prophet. Captain Kassad gave the leaders of the 30 million zealots 3 hours to surrender their hostages and return to their homes on the desert continent of Qum. In the first 3 days of the revolution, the armies of the new prophet had occupied most of the cities on 2 continents and had taken more than 27,000 hegemony hostages. Firing squads had been busy day and night settling ancient theological disputes, and it was estimated that at least 250,000 Sunnis had been slaughtered in the first 2 days of the new prophet's occupation. In response to Kassad's ultimatum, the new prophet announced that all of the infidels would be put to death immediately following his live television address that evening. He also ordered an attack on Kassad's assault boat. Avoiding high explosives because of the Grand Mosque, the Revolutionary Guard used automatic weapons, crude energy cannon, plasma charges, and human wave attacks. The containment field held. The new prophet's televised address began 15 minutes before Kassad's ultimatum ran out. The new prophet agreed with Kassad's statement that Allah would horribly punish heretics, but announced that it was the hegemony infidels who would be so punished. It was the only time the new prophet ever had been seen to lose his temper on camera. Screaming, saliva flying, he ordered the human wave attacks to be renewed on the grounded assault boat. He announced that at that moment, 12 fission bombs were being assembled at the occupied Power for Peace reactor in Ali. With these, the forces of Allah would be carried into space itself. The first fission bomb, he explained, would be used on the infidel Kassad's satanic assault boat that very afternoon. The new prophet then began to explain exactly how the hegemony hostages would be executed. But, at that moment, Kassad's deadline ran out. Qum Riyad was, by its own choice and the accident of its distant location, a technically primitive world. But the inhabitants were not so primitive that they did not have an active datasphere. Nor were the revolutionary mullahs who had led the invasion so opposed to the great Satan of hegemony science that they refused to tie into the global data net with their personal comm logs. The HS Deniev had seeded enough spy sats so that by 17:29 hours, Qum Riyad Central Time, the datasphere had been tapped to the point that the hegemony ship had identified 16,830 revolutionary mullahs by their access codes. At 17:29:30 hours, the spy sats began feeding their real-time targeting data to the 21 perimeter defense sats which Kassad's assault boat had left in low orbit. These orbital defense weapons were so old that the Deniev's mission had been to return them to the web for safe destruction. Kassad had suggested another use for them. At precisely 17:30 hours, 19 of the small satellites detonated their fusion cores. In the nanoseconds before their self-destruction, the resulting X-rays were focused, aimed, and released in 16,830 invisible but very coherent beams. The ancient defense sats were not designed for atmospheric use and had an effective destructive radius of less than a millimeter. Luckily, that was all that was needed. Not all of the targeting beams penetrated whatever stood between the mullahs and the sky. 15,784 did. The effect was immediate and dramatic. In each case, the target's brain and cerebral fluid boiled, turned to vapor, and blew the encasing skull to bits. The new prophet was in the middle of his live, planet-wide broadcast, literally in the middle of pronouncing the word heretic, when 17:30 hours arrived. For almost 2 minutes, the TV screens and walls around the planet carried the image of the new prophet's headless body slumped over the microphone. Then, Fedman Kassad cut in on all bands to announce that his next deadline was 1 hour away and that any actions against the hostages would be met with a more dramatic demonstration of Allah's displeasure. There were no reprisals. That night, in orbit around Qum Riyad, mystery visited Kassad for the first time since his cadet days. He was asleep, but the visit was more than a dream, and less than the alternative reality of the OCS-HTN sims. The woman and he were lying together under a light blanket beneath a broken roof. Her skin was warm and electric, her face little more than a pale outline against nighttime darkness. Overhead, the stars had just begun to fade into the false light of pre-dawn. Kassad realized that she was trying to speak to him. Her soft lips formed words which were just below the threshold of Kassad's hearing. He pulled back a second in order to see her face better and, in so doing, lost contact completely.